From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, helping to rebuild Gaza. The plight of those facing the Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. We'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak, plus the U.S. seizing property from a Guinea official. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was in Cairo on Sunday there for a donor conference on rebuilding parts of the Gaza Strip, which were leveled during 50 days of fighting between Hamas and Israel. VOA's Scott Stearns reports from the Egyptian capital on efforts to restart talks toward a two-state solution to the conflict.
Donors from more than 30 countries pledged $5.4 billion in aid to the Palestinians, half of that for rebuilding Gaza and half for supporting domestic budgets in Palestinian territories. Norwegian Foreign Minister Borje Brende said authorities will follow up on those pledges to make sure they're delivered promptly. The sum is just over half of what the Palestinians say they need for Gaza, reflecting concern among some donors about prospects for more violence after three wars in 6 years. Without an agreement on a lasting ceasefire or a political framework for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Foreign Minister Brende says there are many legitimate questions about why donor countries should once again pick up the bill for rebuilding what warring parties have torn down.
We have not forgotten the issue of a two-state solution. It is back on the international agenda, and there is now a political momentum built up to pressure the parties to get back to the negotiating table.
Secretary Kerry led 9 months of talks on a two-state solution that failed in April. He says the Obama administration remains ready to re-engage in that process, along with allies in Egypt and Jordan.
We have deep hopes that we can see the leaders of both the Palestinian Authority and of Israel make the decision that there are reasons they can see in the current construct of events in the region, the current leadership of the region, President Sisi, King Abdullah of Jordan, others, all of whom want to move in this direction and are ready to contribute to it. And hopefully those leaders will see that this is a moment to actually take advantage of, not to run away from.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called for an immediate start to talks on a fair and comprehensive two-state solution that respects the sovereignty, independence, and dignity of the Palestinian people. But he also repeated calls for an investigation into Israeli military action against civilians during the latest fighting. He's heard here through a translator.
The Israeli offensive and the success and the consequential destruction and destruction of Gaza cannot be tolerated, and it cannot be cannot go away without any accountability.
Israeli officials were not present for these talks, but Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told the UN General Assembly last month that the fact that its Human Rights Council is investigating Israel rather than Hamas has betrayed its noble mission to protect the innocent. Secretary Kerry says breaking this cycle of recrimination and violence means addressing both the immediate concerns on the ground as well as the underlying causes of the discontent and anger, frustration that has fueled this conflict in the first place. Egyptian authorities say they'll reconvene in direct talks between the Israelis and Palestinians later this month, in hopes of following through on some of the undelivered promises surrounding the August ceasefire. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Cairo.
Officials in Iraq's Anbar province say Islamic State militants killed the provincial police chief in a bomb attack that happened on Sunday. Deputy Governor warns that most of Anbar is now under Islamic State control and that the provincial capital, Ramadi, could soon fall without more coalition airstrikes. Edward Uranian reports now from the VOA Middle East Bureau.
Iraqi officials in both Baghdad and Anbar province are sounding alarm bells after a bomb attack killed provincial police chief Ahmed Sadiq al-Dulaimi, who was a top officer in the Iraqi army. before the 2003 U.S.-led invasion. Anbar Council Deputy Head Falah Al-Issawi warns that 80% of the province is now in the hands of Islamic State militants and that the entire province could fall to the group within 15 days without reinforcements from Baghdad and more coalition airstrikes. Issawi says all but two military bases and the Anbar capital Ramadi are now in the hands of the militants. He called on coalition forces to airdrop ammunition to Iraqi forces inside Ramadi, as they did for Iraqi troops who are fighting to keep control of the Beji oil refinery north of Tikrit. In Baghdad, Iraqi security spokesman Saad Man told Iraqi TV that the capital's operations command was conducting joint operations with security forces in Anbar province. He said that government forces plan to call in airstrikes to help defend the Iraqi garrison in Ramadi. Ahmed Hamid Sharaisi, who heads the Anbar Province Security Council, accused Islamic State militants of the coordinated bomb attacks that killed Provincial Police Chief Dulaimi. He went on to call on American troops to help liberate Anbar Province. The Iraqi central government has also called on the U.S. to send ground forces back to help defeat the Islamic State. Sheikh Ahmed Abu Risha, who heads the Anbar Sahwa Council, which helped U.S. troops defeat insurgents in Anbar before the U.S. withdrew its ground forces in 2011, told Al Arabiya TV that the situation in Anbar was critical and that intense airstrikes were needed to help rout Islamic State militants. Further south, Islamic State militants are battling Iraqi security forces even closer to Baghdad, clashing in the suburb of Abu Ghraib. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And America's top military commander says the Islamic State militants are adapting to the U.S.-led air campaign, making targets in Iraq and Syria harder for coalition forces to identify and eliminate. VOA's Michael Bowman reports the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, spoke Sunday, one day after U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel described the task of defeating the militants as difficult and complicated.
Fierce fighting continues in the Syrian Kurdish town of Kobani, where militants posted video showing battles being waged street by street and house by house, trapping civilians and swelling the ranks of refugees. In Iraq, government troops continue to battle Sunni radicals outside Baghdad, where another wave of car bombs left a trail of human carnage. But U.S. military commanders note Islamic State advances on Baghdad and Erbil have been halted, even as militants display new cunning in hiding their positions and movements in response to coalition airstrikes. General Martin Dempsey.
And the enemy adapts, and they'll be harder to target.
Yeah.
They know how to maneuver and how to use populations and concealment. And so when we get a target, we'll take it.
It is a dangerous situation, and we recognize that.
During a visit to Chile, U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said there will be no let-up in the coalition air campaign.
The effort to degrade and eventually destroy ISIL is a long-term effort. This is difficult. It is complicated. It's going to require many factors, as we are working now, coalition partners, a strong, stable, united Iraqi government, a strong Syrian opposition forces, many factors to this. And it's going to take a while. It is not going to be fast. It is not going to be easy.
A more dire assessment came from Republican Senator John McCain, who said Sunday the Islamic State, quote, is winning. General Dempsey said he still does not see a need for U.S. combat troops in Iraq, but could envision benefits of U.S. forces accompanying Iraqi troops in future high-intensity missions, such as to recapture the Islamic State-controlled city of Mosul. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
Each week on Daybreak Asia, we cover the stories of women who are working to change the world.
She was locked up by her family when she reached puberty, which happens to all the Muslim girls in her village. And she then went on to become a politician and an activist. And she's an all-round amazing person, really.
I'm Frances Alonso, producer of Women Rising. Listen for my reports about the empowerment of women around the world on Daybreak Asia and on the web at voanews.com.
Hong Kong's leaders expressing defiance in the weeks-long standoff with protesters there, student protesters, most of them, over democratic reforms in the Chinese territory. Chief Executive Leon Chung-ying Sunday said that he would not step down, a key demand of the protesters. Protesters did remain out on the streets on Sunday, hundreds of them camping in lines and setting up tents in the streets. For some perspective on what's happening in Hong Kong, VOA's Carol Castiel spoke with two analysts. David N. Lampton is a professor and director of Chinese studies at the School of Advanced International Studies, and Dean Chung is senior research fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. Here's Carol Castiel.
Well, David M. Lampton, often known as Mike, we'll refer to you as David, here for our purposes. I'd like to get your reaction to this protest movement. We know it's not monolithic. There are some in Hong Kong who perhaps are not with the students and others who are protesting. Talk about what triggered the movement and how the authorities reacted.
Well, I think there are two broad triggers. One is what you might say a sort of cultural clash between popular perception and opinion on mainland China and that of locals who live in Hong Kong. And there have been lots of people from the mainland coming into Hong Kong, special administrative region, buying milk, taking up spaces in the hospital, driving up property prices. So there's a lot of resentment in Hong Kong against the mainland for reasons that have little to do with the politics, actually, and lots of resentment to the mainlanders who think their cousins in Hong Kong aren't very welcoming. And there's a body of opinion in the PRC that says Hong Kong people have it too good. So there's that kind of dynamic. Then there's the political, and this is, in some sense, a democracy movement. But it's complicated because Beijing thinks it's actually moved forward having a popular election, what they would call universal suffrage, in 2017. Beijing sees that as a move forward, but it's not enough to the people of Hong Kong, or at least the people in the streets, which I think represents a lot. And that is because the election will only be able to be among people that are vetted by a large nominating committee. And so the PRC, I think, sees this as a step forward having an election at all, but it's insufficient for the people of Hong Kong because they will have it circumscribed who they can even vote for.
Turning to you, Dean Chang, very interesting points by David M. Lampton. We have the disconnect between those in Hong Kong vis-a-vis the mainland. They're not very happy about some of the mainlanders coming in, taking jobs, housing, and so on. But there's also this political issue. They want their elections in 2017 to be freer. So my question to you is, what was the agreement originally in 2017? Are the protesters who want these freer elections, are they taking it a step further? Or was the agreement really to have these so-called nominees for chief executive, were they supposed to be vetted? And now the protesters are saying, well, that's just not good enough.
Well, I think what we are seeing here is the maturing of China's ability to play legal games almost as well as the U.S. does. The reality is that the joint declaration between the U.K. and China and then the subsequent basic law didn't say specifically exactly what would and wouldn't occur. The issue of
room for interpretation,
plenty of room for interpretation. The Chinese government, legally speaking, seems to actually be upholding its part of the agreement, which is universal suffrage. So if you are legally entitled to vote in Hong Kong, and they have a very consistent way of defining that, you will be allowed to vote. Where Beijing has stepped in is who you would be allowed to vote for. So it's a violation of the spirit of the agreement. But from a lawyer's perspective, I suspect, Beijing has both legs to stand on. Now, the issue here, unfortunately, politically, got really exacerbated because within this tension in June, Beijing issued a white paper on Hong Kong, their first. And here, they went much further. They basically said, one country, two system really is subordinating two systems to one country. And you, Hong Kong, first have to show that you are loyal to Beijing. And that really set everyone's teeth on edge so that when the declaration then came out that said, oh, and we're going to have this committee vet all of the candidates, it really made something of a mockery of one country, two systems. So that's why you see people like Chris Patten, the last British governor of Hong Kong, saying, this is not what we agreed to.
Well, turning back to you, David Mike Lambton, now we seem to be at a bit of a standoff here. Talk about the protesters themselves. To what extent do they represent the majority of Hong Kongers, so to speak? To what extent they are representative?
Well, first of all, the demonstrators in the street are not all students. There are what we'll call the old democracy movement, the people in their 50s and 60s that have been doing this for a long time, and there have been many protests before this current large-scale protest. So this is actually a heterogeneous movement, and they all are in the streets for different combinations of reasons. But broadly speaking, I would say the democracy motivation is a big motivation, and that without firm data, probably a majority of the people in Hong Kong sympathize with the idea of broadening out the electoral process. But if you think about it in interest group terms, there is the what you might call the very big business community in Hong Kong, what's often referred to as the tycoons, and they sent fairly recently a group to Beijing to talk to the central leadership. And these people want stability and a good business environment, and people in the streets shutting down the art are not a good business environment. So if you think about the distribution of interest group power in Hong Kong, the people favoring stability, as they would see it, are very powerful.
And when you say they're favoring stability, are they more on the side of the protesters, or are they leaning toward Beijing? Because it's hard to know.
Well, where do they stand? I don't want to say that all tycoons have exactly the same views,
sure,
but they have similar views. And I think their view would be rather like Dean Chung just articulated, is that actually Beijing moved forward in having universal suffrage election in narrow construction, and that, of course, we do want to continue to move forward in the future, but this is a step forward, and therefore we ought to recognize the progress Beijing's made and push maybe for some compromise on the nominating committee and how that's going to happen. But in the end, I think the business community wants to get the people off the streets at the lowest possible cost to political concession.
That is David M. Lambton. He is a professor and director of Chinese Studies at the School of Advanced and International Studies. And Dean Chung, senior research fellow in the Asia Studies Center of the Heritage Foundation, spoke with VOA's Carol Castiel on our program Encounter. You can hear more of their conversation at our website, voanews.com. Just look under the Programs tab for Encounter.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Medical workers in Liberia are set to go on strike over a pay dispute today, a move that could deliver a serious blow to the fight against the deadly Ebola virus. Thousands of members of Liberia's National Health Workers Association are demanding $700 in monthly hazard pay on top of their monthly salaries that are around $200 or $300 a month. Liberia has the highest number of infections and deaths in the worst outbreak of Ebola so far. Meantime, in the United States, President Obama calling for immediate steps to ensure the U.S. medical system is ready to follow the proper protocols for treating Ebola patients. Mr. Obama ordered the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to quickly investigate how a nurse at a Texas hospital contracted the virus. The nurse was part of a team treating the first Ebola patient to be diagnosed in the United States, Thomas Duncan, who died last week. CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden spoke Sunday about what comes next.
Unfortunately, it is possible in the coming days that we will see additional cases of Ebola. This is because the healthcare workers who cared for this individual may have had a breach of the same nature of the individual who appears now to have a preliminary positive test. The bottom line is, we know how Ebola spreads. We know how to stop it from spreading. But it does reemphasize how meticulous we have to be on every single aspect of the control measures, from rapid diagnosis to effective isolation to effective care with infection control to scrupulous contact investigation.
Texas officials say the health worker wore full protective gear and complied with CDC guidelines when she had contact with Thomas Duncan. And in Spain, authorities say a woman in Madrid infected with Ebola remains in serious condition but is showing slight signs of improvement. The new U.S. case comes as several airports began a stepped-up program to screen passengers from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, where thousands of people who died from the virus. Britain also introducing screening procedures at some of their airports and train stations. World Health Organization says the Ebola outbreak in West Africa has killed at least 4,000 people, with about 8,400 reported cases. Equatorial Guinea's second vice president, Teodoro N'Gama Obiang, has been ordered by the U.S. Justice Department to sell more than $30 million worth of property it believes was bought using illegally obtained assets from corrupt business deals. Jennifer Lazuta reports.
The United States Department of Justice says the son of Equatorial Guinea's president must forfeit his U.S.-based property and belongings, including a mansion in Malibu, California, Michael Jackson memorabilia, and luxury cars, which are believed to have been purchased using money from illegal dealings in his home country. The civil forfeiture case, alleging nearly $80 million from proceeds of corruption, was originally brought against Teodoro N'Gama Obiang in 2011. Ken Hurwitz is a senior legal officer for anti-corruption at the Open Society Justice Initiative.
It's an extraordinary case in that this is the first case where a living person whose assets were being seized. So this is historic in that sense. It's the first case in the United States where the attempt is to seize assets that are owned by the current rulers, people who still retain power in their countries.
Hurwitz said previous cases have all happened years after the person has died or left power, often making it difficult to track down and define the assets allegedly stolen by those individuals. The Obiang family has ruled Equatorial Guinea for more than 30 years. Despite vast and profitable oil and gas reserves, the World Bank says more than three-quarters of the population lives below the poverty line. Hurwitz said this case also shows how difficult it is to show how this level of corruption occurs.
I think that there is a disappointment that the case will not meet its potential of really exposing in great detail how the corruption works and how money is laundered and how the money is stolen from the public funds of the country, how extortion and self-dealing take place in the country, and perhaps most importantly, how the money is laundered, that is to say, the role of lawyers and middlemen and bankers and brokers in assisting to grease the wheels of the abuse.
Obiang, who is notorious for his lavish lifestyle and playboy ways, says all the items were purchased using money from legal business deals. The Open Society Justice Initiative says that the money from the sale of Obiang's U.S.-based belongings will be given to charitable organizations to benefit the people of Equatorial Guinea. Under a settlement with the Justice Department, Obiang will get to keep his remaining overseas assets, including Michael Jackson's famous white crystal glove and a $38.5 million Gulfstream jet, although they could be seized if brought to the United States. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News, Dakar.
And Pope Francis has held a mass of thanksgiving for the canonization of two 17th century missionaries for what they did in what is today Canada. St. Francis de Laval was the first bishop of what was called New France and known for his work to defend Native Americans from exploitation. Sainte Marie of the Incarnation was an Ursuline nun who founded a convent and a school that provided equal education to the daughters of French settlers and Native Americans. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Sid Rack Franklin, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On October 13th, 54, the Roman Emperor Claudius was poisoned under mysterious circumstances. He died, and his 17-year-old stepson Nero succeeded him. On this day in 1307, hundreds of Knights Templar in France were arrested by agents of King Philip IV. The king owed money to the Templars and resented their power. The arrested Templars were later tortured into confessing to heresy. Some were burned alive. In 1775, the Continental Congress authorized the construction of two warships, the beginning of the U.S. Navy. In 1798, Congress established the Department of the Navy amid a conflict with Barbary pirates. On this day, during the War of 1812, British and Indian forces under Sir Isaac Brock defeated an American army at the Battle of Queenstown Heights in Ontario. The victory blocked American plans to invade Canada. In 1843, B'nai B'rith, or Sons of the Covenant, one of the oldest Jewish service organizations in the world, was founded in New York City by Henry Jones and 11 others. It is an international organization engaged in a wide variety of humanitarian activities. In 1923, on this day, Ankara was officially declared the capital of Turkey, replacing Istanbul. In 1943, dictator Benito Mussolini was deposed. The Italian government then declared war on its former Axis partner, Germany. On this day in 1946, French voters adopted the Constitution of the Fourth Republic. It didn't last long. Instability and the loss of the French Empire resulted in a Fifth French Republic being formed in 1958. In 1983, Ameritech Mobile Communications, now AT&T, launched the first U.S. cellular network in Chicago, Illinois. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Every year, the United States sets aside certain days to mark the historical events and principles we value most as a nation. The Fall Harvest Festival of Thanksgiving honors the example set by America's earliest settlers, for example. Independence Day in July celebrates our founding as a free nation and the sacrifices of those who died in military service defending ours and others' liberties are marked every May on Memorial Day. On the second Monday of October, we commemorate the voyage of discovery by Europeans to the Americas and the man who led it, Christopher Columbus. In a larger sense, though, it is a celebration of the cultural diversity brought by the waves of immigrants who followed the Italian explorer to these shores and the strength that their diversity has brought our nation. That heritage is enshrined in our nation's great seal with the Latin inscription, E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one. On October 12, 1492, three ships commissioned by the King of Spain made landfall among the outer islands of what is now the Bahamas chain in the Caribbean Ocean. Their commander, Columbus, had been tasked with finding a faster, more direct route from Europe to the trading centers of Asia. Instead, he found for Europeans an entire new world. Columbus was a child of the Renaissance, a revival of the learning, culture, and spirit of ancient Greece and Rome, notably preserved by Muslim scholars. The invention of the printing press in 1440 spurred a revolution in communication and learning. The works of the ancient Greek philosophers and other classical thinkers were widely published, and many began to question age-old assumptions about the physical world and human relations. The New Learning, as it was called, led men to question authoritarian political systems based on the so-called divine right of kings. English political philosopher John Locke argued that all legitimate government rests on the consent of the governed. He wrote that religious faith is a matter of individual conscience, not state direction, and that where one faith is persecuted, no faith is secure. Empowered by these ideas, thousands upon thousands of Europeans followed Columbus's path to new lives in the New World. Asserting the right of all men to freedom, they established the United States and transformed a wilderness into the freest and most productive nation in history. It is that legacy that we celebrate today.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.